17 seconds and counting. Guidance internal. 15, 14, 13, 12, 11, 10, 9. We have ignition sequence start. Engines on. 5, 4, 3, 2.
Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are willing to control, and one we intend to win.
Okay, engine stop. ATA at a descent. Flight control both auto descent and command override on. And then I'm on. 413 is in.
We got to get down, Eagle.
Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Today's guest on Cosmic Perspective was the Chief Mission Engineer and Mission Director on NASA's Deep Space One mission. He is the recipient of 3 NASA Exceptional Achievement Medals and 2 Outstanding Leadership Medals. He is now the Chief Engineer and Mission Director on NASA's Dawn mission that launched in 2007, and it visited the largest asteroid in the solar system, Vesta, and is now on its way to visit and orbit the dwarf planet Ceres in 2015. Dr. Mark Raymond, thanks for being with us today on Cosmic Perspective.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate your interest.
Asteroid Vesta and dwarf planet Ceres are the largest objects in the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. What makes these objects so intriguing to scientists?
Well, part of what makes them so intriguing is exactly what you said. It's because they're so large. I mean, most people think of asteroids as, you know, sort of little chunks of rock the size of buildings or mountains or something like that. But these are entirely different from regular asteroids. These are very, very large. In fact, in my view, they're among the last unexplored worlds in the inner solar system. And so there's a lot there that we have not previously studied. And these objects really present the opportunity to learn a great deal more about the nature of our solar system. And I guess I should also say that besides the scientific appeal, which I know we'll talk about some more, this is exploration, right? We're all curious about what's out there. And these are, again, they're large bodies. They're not just little chips of rock. And they've been known about for more than 200 years. In fact, Ceres is the largest body between the Sun and Pluto that has not yet been visited by a spacecraft. So to me, there's just a real powerful allure there, a draw. These are celestial bodies that beckon, and finally Earth is answering.
I think what's interesting about these two objects is they're very different from each other.
They are. That's right. Vesta, which is just a little bit closer to the Sun, is rocky and had a very hot history. That is, it was determined from telescopic observations that it was covered with basalt, which indicates that it had had lava covering its surface. So it was hot, and at least it was at some time in the past. And so it's in many ways, as we now know from the Dawn mission, it's more like the rocky bodies of the inner solar system, one of which is right under our feet, Earth, as well as Mercury, Venus, the Moon, and Mars. It's much more like those bodies than it is like typical asteroids. Now, Ceres, just a little bit farther from the Sun, although we haven't yet had a spacecraft visit it, we already have good reason to believe that it never was hot in its past. It may have a substantial inventory of water and may have ice on or near the surface. And so it's more like the icy moons of the outer solar system of Jupiter and Saturn and the other planets. And so it's almost as if these two bodies straddle what some astronomers call a snow line or a dew line or a frost line in the solar system. And so that also will make it very intriguing not only to study each one, but to compare them.
Both of these objects were considered planets at one time. I find that very interesting also.
Yeah, I do too, and you're absolutely right. Now, Ceres was discovered in 1801, and Vesta was discovered in 1807. And at that time, the known planets ranged from Mercury to Uranus. Neptune had not yet been discovered. And these very nicely fit into the gap between Mars and Jupiter. And so many astronomers considered them and two other bodies in what we now call the asteroid belt to be planets. They were recognized to be smaller because they weren't so bright, but still, that's how they were viewed. But then as scientific knowledge advanced and technology progressed, and in the middle of the 19th century, many more asteroids started to be discovered, astronomers decided that the term planet really wasn't appropriate for them, and so they came to be known as asteroids. And I would point out that Pluto has had a similar history. It was discovered much, much later than Ceres. Pluto was discovered 129 years later, but still, after its discovery in 1930, it was considered to be a planet because it was, even though known to be much smaller than the other planets, it still seemed to fit the bill. Until, again, as scientific knowledge and technology advanced, more and more bodies started to be discovered out in that part of the solar system. It was recognized that Pluto wasn't unique after all. And so the vocabulary changed to reflect the progress in scientific understanding. In fact, I guess I would just add that both Pluto and Ceres are designated as dwarf planets. That is, in 2006, when the International Astronomical Union created this new category called dwarf planets, Ceres fit into it as well. It satisfies all of the attributes of a dwarf planet that Pluto does.
So Pluto wasn't the only object that was reclassified from a planet to a different type of object.
That's right. And again, this, in my view, this is simply a reflection of the progress of scientific understanding. We have a more sophisticated understanding of the cosmos now than we did when Pluto was discovered, and we had a more sophisticated understanding then than when Ceres was discovered. And as scientific knowledge advances, we update and change our vocabulary to reflect that.
If I remember when I was a kid and I was looking at my textbook in grade school, and it said that all planets had a rocky core, and you know, we keep redefining what a planet is, and that I think that's exciting.
I do too. To me, one of the most exciting things is not only learning new things, but learning that some of our old ideas were not quite right, and that's the success of science. Science works because it can be improved, because our understanding can always advance. We can take advantage of new discoveries, of new knowledge, to improve our insight into the nature of the universe. And what can be more exciting than that?
Yes, and I think that's why the Dawn mission is so exciting. Dawn launched in 2007, correct? And reached
that's
Vesta
right.
in 2011 and orbited
right.
for more than a year, is that correct?
That's right. So it orbited for 14 months, and this is the only spacecraft that's ever orbited a body in the main asteroid belt. Again, as a reminder, the main asteroid belt is between Mars and Jupiter, and spacecraft had flown past a few main belt asteroids before, although none nearly as large as Vesta. But this was the first time that we had orbited a body there. And I think it was really exciting because Vesta is a big place. And it's, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, it's now considered to be more like the terrestrial planets than it is like what most people think of as asteroids, which are just these irregular chunks of rock.
What were the Dawn mission's findings after studying the asteroid Vesta for more than a year?
We discovered a lot of, I think, really exciting things about Vesta. First of all, we took pictures of the entire surface, so we now have detailed maps of the surface of an alien world that had been glimpsed only as a fuzzy little tiny dot amidst the stars for 2 centuries. And so now we can see all the craters and mountains and cliffs and plains and all the other features on the surface. And some of the things we see are, for example, a crater 300 miles in diameter. I mean, just think of that, 300 miles. It's one of the largest craters that we know. And in the center of this crater is a mountain 110 miles across at the base. And the peak of the mountain soars to an elevation above the floor of the crater equal to 2.5 times the height of Mount Everest above sea level. This is just amazing. I mean, there's nothing like this on your planet, nor on mine. And if you just think about being in the middle of a 300-mile diameter crater with this huge mountain in the center, and the walls of the crater extend up to nearly 3 times the height of Mount Everest. This is entirely unlike what we see on Earth. And in fact, this huge mountain is now the second tallest mountain known in the solar system. The only one that's higher, and it's just a little higher, is the famous Olympus Mons on Mars. And this crater is the result of a huge impact that occurred perhaps a billion or more years ago. And when the crater was formed, of course, it was formed by another piece of debris in the asteroid belt, an object maybe something like 30 miles or 50 miles, something like that in diameter, slammed into Vesta, excavated this huge crater. It put so much energy into Vesta, hit it so powerfully that Vesta almost was destroyed. And it reverberated with all this energy that it had been hit with. And that caused disruptions far, far away from the crater. Now, the crater is centered near the South Pole, but the powerful impact left huge chasms near the equator, hundreds and hundreds of miles away. And these chasms, in some cases, are larger than the Grand Canyon. So this also is really amazing.
This is not an object that's only 350 miles in diameter.
That's right. So a 350-mile diameter object with a crater 300 miles in diameter.
Wow.
If it were scaled up to Earth, if Vesta were scaled up to Earth, this crater would be so large it would extend from Washington, D.C. over the North Pole to Tokyo. And if I can just add still something more, the impact that excavated this crater and that disrupted Vesta so much that it carved this network of nearly 100 chasms also sprayed a lot of this material out into space. And then these rocks that were thrown away from Vesta, in some cases, of course, fell back to the surface. But in other cases, they were lofted with so much energy that they went into their own orbits around the sun. And some of them then made their way to the part of the solar system where you and I spend most of our time, and they fall into Earth as meteorites. And we now know that a huge fraction of the meteorites seem to fall on Earth. It is about 1 out of every 16 meteorites, 6%, came from that one impact at Vesta. I'm sure you know, and most of your listeners know, that we have meteorites from Mars. And maybe people know we have meteorites we believe to be from the moon as well. But we have far, far more meteorites from Vesta than we do from the moon or Mars. And those are the only three solar system bodies to which we have linked specific meteorites.
How do scientists know that these pieces of rock that we find on the Earth are actually from Vesta?
The original connection between the meteorites and Vesta was made in the early 1970s when astronomers started using infrared detectors. So infrared, of course, is a wavelength of light that our eyes are not sensitive to, but that we can still detect, just as there are sounds that our ears can't detect, but the dogs can detect. And when they looked at this infrared light from Vesta, they broke up the light, much like a prism breaks up light. So when a prism breaks up white light, we see all the individual colors, the colors of the rainbow, literally. And when you do that in the infrared and look at it in great detail, you can actually see the signature of the material that reflected the light. So you can tell something about the composition of that material. So when astronomers looked at the infrared light from Vesta, they recognized that it was a perfect match for this broad class of meteorites that had been collected on Earth. And that was the first step in making the connection. There are other steps as well, and really essentially the final story in making the connection was having Dawn at Vesta to make more detailed measurements from orbit to show that indeed this class of meteorites is a very, very good match for the minerals that Dawn was able to observe from close orbit around Vesta. And so now that means we have this tremendous number of samples blasted from Vesta and delivered to Earth that allow us to gain still further insight into its geological nature.
So through spectrum analysis, there's no doubt the signature is there, that these
are from
Vesta.
Right. It's a very, very solid case.
Even with such a large impact that occurred on Vesta, I still think it's amazing that such a large percentage of meteorites on this Earth are from Vesta.
It is. And if you have seen meteorites in a museum, there's a good chance that you've actually seen a piece of Vesta.
Maybe some of our listeners will be out looking for meteorites soon.
I hope so. I think it's neat. In fact, meteorites are what got me interested in space in the first place. So I share the interest.
Dawn has left Vesta. We'll catch up with Ceres and orbit it in 2015. It'll be the first mission to visit a dwarf planet. What do you expect to find?
Well, so you're right. It has left Vesta. In fact, just as an aside, it's the only spacecraft that's ever orbited a distant extraterrestrial body and then left it to go on to another. And maybe we'll talk more about that later. But at Ceres, we expect to see something very different from Vesta. In some sort of superficial sense, Vesta kind of looks like the moon. It's a rocky, airless body, has a lot of craters, and a lot of other features that are in detail different from the moon, but it's superficially like that. But Ceres is very different. We expect Ceres to have a substantial amount of ice and rock as well, but it probably will not look the same as Vesta. It's larger, first of all, and because it has ice and maybe even subsurface liquid water, Ceres, first of all, probably won't have as many big, deep craters as Vesta does, because over long geological times, the surface may be able to gently erase the scars from the impacts. Because it's compared to solid rock, it's relatively soft. It's the same thing as your skin itself. If you push on your skin, you can make a depression. But over time, because your skin is soft, it'll relax and eventually that depression will disappear. And it could be that the same thing is happening on Ceres. Another thing that we'll be specifically looking for is evidence of water, probably below the surface. I mean, certainly there won't be any water on the surface. Maybe there will be ice, but there may be some compelling evidence of interaction between the surface and subsurface water or evidence of ice on the surface. And I think that will be very intriguing to look for.
And that those findings were from a different spacecraft, the Herschel spacecraft. Is that correct?
It is. Now, there have been, even before Herschel, there were several lines of evidence that suggested that Ceres may have some water in some form. But what you're referring to is a very exciting discovery announced earlier this year that a European Space Agency spacecraft called the Herschel Space Observatory made distant observations of Ceres. It's essentially a space-based telescope, and it was able to detect the faint but definite signature of water vapor over Ceres. So, well, if it's water vapor, the water vapor had to come from somewhere, and clearly it came from Ceres itself. And so whether it's a result of perhaps ice on or near the surface sublimating, that is like evaporating directly into space, or maybe even something more exotic like geysers or what scientists sometimes call cryovolcanoes, cryo, of course, meaning cold, and everybody knows what a volcano is. So these would not be erupting lava, but rather erupting water from inside Ceres, shooting it out into space. So we don't know how the water vapor got into the space above Ceres, but we know that it got there somehow. And so when dawn is there, that's, of course, something we'll be looking for.
Ceres and Pluto are both dwarf planets. How do they compare in size and composition?
Well, so Pluto is larger than Ceres. Pluto is a little over 1,400 miles in diameter. Ceres is about 600. So Pluto is a little bit more than twice the diameter. And as for composition, we don't really have yet a good understanding of what the composition actually of either body is. All we can see are these faint smudges without really a lot of information in detail. And so I think the best answer to your question is, ask me again in a year, because
yes.
Fortunately, we as enthusiastic explorers of the cosmos are lucky that next year we will have spacecraft finally visiting two dwarf planets, Ceres, the first one discovered, and Pluto, the second one discovered, will both be visited by spacecraft. The New Horizons mission, which I think is a very, very exciting mission. I don't work on it, and I can't represent it in detail, but it will fly past Pluto and collect a lot of information on Pluto and its moons, and Dawn, of course, will study Ceres. So we're on the verge of learning so much more about these dwarf planets that had been learned in the previous two centuries.
Dawn is a spacecraft that can go into orbit around an object and leave that object and go to another one. What technology does the spacecraft have that makes it so unique?
Well, that's a good question, because this is, so just to put a fine point on it, in more than 56 years of space exploration, we've never before tried to have a spacecraft orbit two different extraterrestrial destinations. And it's because that capability is far, far, far beyond what is achievable with conventional chemical propulsion. It just takes a lot of propulsion to break into orbit around a body and then leave it. So you have to fire up an engine and depart and then travel to another body and go into orbit around it. So chemical propulsion is just not up to that task. And the reason Dawn is able to do it is because instead of that technology, it uses ion propulsion, which I think is a really cool technology. First time I ever even heard of it was in science fiction. I think that's probably where, if anybody has heard of it, that's where they're most likely to have first heard of it. And to me, one of the rewards of working on a project like this is getting to turn that science fiction into science fact. And because ion propulsion is 10 times more effective than chemical propulsion, so it would be like having your car get 300 miles per gallon, it allows us to undertake missions that are just far beyond what chemical propulsion would be capable of achieving.
with iron propulsion, you've been able to go to these great distances with very little bit of fuel. How does the engine work? I know that this starts very slowly and gradually builds up to a very fast speed, I guess, or velocity. Is that correct?
It is. So for how it works, let me first just remind your listeners of how a regular rocket engine works. You take a gas and you heat it up or you put it under pressure and you push it out of a rocket nozzle. And the action of the gas leaving the nozzle causes a reaction that pushes the spacecraft in the other direction. This is the same thing you observe if you just let go of the open end of a balloon. The gas shooting out of the balloon, the air shooting out of the balloon pushes the balloon in the other direction. And ion propulsion works the same way, but we don't heat the gas up or put it under pressure. Instead, we start with the gas as xenon, which is like helium or neon, but heavier, and we give it a little electric charge. And when it has a charge, it's called an ion. And when it has a charge, it can feel the effect of a voltage. So we put a large voltage on these xenon ions, and that allows us to shoot them out of the spacecraft at fantastically high speed, 90,000 miles per hour. And so the action of these xenon ions racing out of the engine causes a reaction that pushes it in the other direction. And because they're so fast, the xenon ions give a relatively large push on the spacecraft. And that's what makes it so efficient. However, we only flow a very, very small amount of xenon through the engine at a time, just a few milligrams per second. And so while the thrust is efficient, it's also very, very gentle, which means that, as you said, it takes a while to build up the speed. The analogy I always like to offer is that the ion engine pushes on the spacecraft about as hard as a single piece of paper would push on your hand. So if you just hold a regular sheet of 8.5 by 11 paper, that paper is pushing on your hand about as hard as our ion engine pushes on the Dawn spacecraft. But of course, in the zero gravity, frictionless environment of space, gradually the effect of this thrust can build up. So at maximum throttle level, it would take Dawn 4 days to accelerate just from 0 to 60 miles per hour, which doesn't exactly make you think of a hot rod. But instead of thrusting for 4 days, if we thrust for a week or a month or a year, or as Dawn already has for more than 4.5 years, or as it ultimately will for 5.5 years, you can achieve fantastically high velocity. And so this is what I like to call acceleration with patience. And if you're patient, and I am, I'm a very patient guy, this is a great way to explore the solar system. And that's really the key to what gives Dawn the capability to undertake truly a unique mission.
How fast is Dawn going at this point in time?
Well, today, it has changed its speed since launch by more than 22,500 miles per hour. And to put that into context, to go from the surface of Earth to Earth orbit only takes about 17,500 miles per hour. So this one spacecraft all by itself has already changed its own velocity by more than multi-stage rockets that go from Earth to Earth orbit. And we still have more to go.
I'd like to talk a little bit about distances. The International Space Station, I believe, is about 250 nautical miles above the surface of the Earth. How does that compare to Dawn's position in the solar system?
So you're right. The space station's about 250 miles away. You and I'm in Los Angeles, or the Los Angeles area. I'm actually in Pasadena. You're near Bridgeport, Connecticut. We're 2,500 miles apart. Right? We're 10 times farther apart than the space station is from the surface of Earth. So the space station is in space, of course, and it's neat, but it's not in any sense remote from Earth. Whereas Dawn, for example, is very, very far. It's 270 million miles away. It's more than a million times farther from Earth than the space station is. It's well over 1,000 times farther away than the moon is from Earth. It's almost 3 times farther away than the sun is from Earth. And I think this is really neat. I think this is really, in fact, more than neat. I think this is profound. I think there's something really remarkable about the capability of humankind to have spacecraft that are farther away than our sun. I think this is an important reflection of the special combinations of curiosity, ingenuity, passion, persistence, diligence, and a number of other, I think, admirable attributes of humankind that we can reach out into the cosmos. We're not limited to the range of our humble home here on Earth. And I would include the space station as being pretty much on Earth, because while it's impressive to be sure, and I love what happens with the human space exploration as well, it really is entirely different from sending objects just far, far from Earth or even from the Earth-Moon system onto their own independent courses through the cosmos. I think that is really something very special.
At the end of Dawn's mission, will there be enough fuel left in Dawn's engines to go further and faster?
Well, so first of all, Dawn's mission will end in probably 2016, so a couple of years from now, but that will have been almost 9 years after launch. There would be enough xenon propellant left to go someplace else, but there's another more important limitation to Dawn's ultimate lifetime. And that is, the spacecraft is equipped with devices called reaction wheels. These are disks that are spun electrically. And by changing the speed at which they spin, we can rotate or stabilize the rotation of the spacecraft in the zero gravity of spaceflight. And when we designed and built and launched Dawn, the intent was that we would always use 3 of these wheels. And so in the usual spirit of redundancy and robustness and the careful attention to detail that we always have on these NASA missions, because we needed 3, we carried 4 so that we would be able to tolerate any one of them failing. Unfortunately, as it's turned out, 2 of them have failed. And Dawn wasn't built to operate with fewer than 3 wheels. And failures like that on missions could have truly dire consequences. Fortunately, however, the very professional, expert Dawn flight team has come up with a way around this, and we're going to accomplish our entire mission now. We don't have to give up any of our original objectives, regardless of the state, even of the remaining 2 wheels. So we're going to have, or in fact, we have what I call a zero reaction wheel plan. So we're going to fully explore Ceres, even if the remaining 2 wheels don't operate. But the result of that is that we're going to use up another supply of a small conventional propulsion system that's on board the Dawn spacecraft. Uses a propellant called hydrazine. And unlike xenon, the xenon is meant to push the spacecraft to its destinations, to change its velocity. This other propellant, hydrazine, which we just have a small supply of, we can use to help rotate the spacecraft. So although it's not as efficient as the reaction wheels, we can still use it that way. So we've invested a really huge effort in finding ways to conserve that hydrazine and stretch the supply so that it would last through the end of the exploration of Ceres, but there won't be much left by the time we're finished in mid-2016. And so because of that, we will not have the capability to send Dawn elsewhere. On the other hand, at that point, we will have explored two uncharted worlds for much less than many missions take even to study one. And so I don't think there's any reason to view that as anything other than a remarkable and very, very gratifying mission. But that's where it will end.
Yes, a remarkable success. Dr. Raymond, thanks for offering your time to be with us today to discuss this one-of-a-kind mission. Are there any links to things that people, listeners, can go to find more about what's going on with the Dawn mission?
Yeah, that's right. Good question. Well, we have a website. So the mission is Dawn, D-A-W-N. So the website is dawn.jpl.nasa.gov. And you can see there many of the pictures that we took at Vesta. Now, we took 31,000 pictures. You can't see all of them there, but there are actually links to where you could find all of them. But we have some of the best there, as well as information about the spacecraft, what to expect at Ceres. And I write a monthly feature called the Dawn Journal that if people would like to follow along, they can get a sense of what it's like to be in control of a spacecraft farther away than the sun. Sometimes it's exciting. Actually, it's always exciting. Sometimes it's scary. Sometimes it's stressful. Sometimes it's fascinating. Sometimes it's inspiring. And I try to bring readers along on every aspect of it.
Again, if you'd like to follow the Dawn website and Dr. Raymond's blog, go to www.dawn.jpl.nasa.gov. Thanks very much again for being with us today. And if you would like to visit us again and give us some updates, of course, you already have them on your blogs, but we'd be welcome to come back and tell us a little bit more what's going on. We'd greatly appreciate it.
Well, thanks. That would be my pleasure. And again, I appreciate your interest. I think you personally do a great job helping your listeners find out what's going on in all kinds of fascinating areas of space exploration. And so I'm grateful to you as well.
Well, thanks for bringing the wonders of the Dawn mission to my listeners. It's greatly appreciated. Thanks again. Take care.
You too.
Cosmic Perspective is an Andy Panero's production.